the future of China now, and of course that affects us. It's not the same as World War II when Peter Fraser declared of Britain, where she goes, we go, but economically a version of that sort of applies. China was New Zealand's top trading partner last year. 23% of all our goods and services exports were with China, more than $20 billion worth. So it's interesting to have a look at China's own prospects now. Last week in our coverage of the National People's Congress there, we heard differing versions of how much internal turmoil there may be and whether Xi Jinping and the Communist Party have firm control. This week we're going to look more at what's happening outside China with implications for it and us with Professor Jane Golley, because she's been writing about this. Dr. Jane Golley is an economist and she's director of the Australian National University's Australian Centre on China in the World. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Australia's being punished by China because Scott Morrison spoke out in favour of a coronavirus origins inquiry. But to set the scene, you say China is facing its own worst nightmare in a way. Why is that?
Well, the COVID-19 crisis has been terrible for everyone, but obviously it started in China. They were the first to take the hard hits on the infections. Their economy, of course, was the first to be shut down, and you know they've recorded their lowest GDP growth rate or negative growth rate in decades, and they're now facing the very difficult task of trying to build the economy up again, ensure that reinfections don't occur, and also convince the rest of the world that you know, this isn't all and only their fault.
Yeah. Let's get to the Belt and Road, this huge 6,000-kilometre sea route slash road looping around Southeast Asia through to Africa, and the Belt with its huge railway and road infrastructure driving Chinese trade and influence, of course, right through to the Middle East and Europe. How much has China invested?
I don't think anyone knows the actual number. What we heard, you know, a couple of years ago is that they had at least $1 trillion of surplus capital to spend. I heard some estimates going up as high as $8 trillion. There are projects engaging countries, you know, in Africa, in the South Pacific. So it's a much more expansive plan that is largely about placing Chinese capital in locations to strengthen transport and trading links between those countries that are, I guess, in some sense perceived as friendly to China.
Yeah, and it was, we kind of thought, going to make this China's century, and there are question marks around that now. You say China is going to have to choose between its big expenditures that you've just been talking about and keeping its own economy going and keeping its own people happy.
I think there will be more pressure on the government to direct it inwards. And they've also got more motivation to do that now because as those tensions continue to rise with the US and China, the trade war just doesn't look like being solved. It actually makes sense for the Chinese government to invest internally to try and stimulate domestic demand. And that solves multiple, I think, priorities for them. Imagine if you're sitting in a poor village in rural China and you hear that money is being poured out into Africa, you'd probably feel a little bit disgruntled. But I think the propaganda machine within China deals with that pretty effectively. You know, they tell a story of China's engagement in the world, bringing prosperity to all, both within China and beyond. And so there is a nationalistic element to that, which I think a lot of the Chinese people actually buy into. I always make the point that China is and has been for a long time now the largest capital surplus country in the world. So just a few years ago, they had at least $4 trillion worth of capital that they could invest abroad. And there is no other country that can match that. Now, that number's falling pretty fast in recent times, but they're still the ones with the capital. And then you turn to countries like Australia, the United States, massive capital deficit countries. So we've always relied on foreign investment coming in. If you don't take it from China, as those Chinese capital stocks continue to fall, it's not going to be coming from anywhere else. And I think you'll find it increasingly difficult to attract Chinese investment, you know, vis-a-vis all of the other countries in the world, and particularly if you're deemed to be unfriendly towards them.
Yeah. Well, China's become a bigger lender than the IMF or the World Bank, hasn't it?
I'm not sure of the exact figures there, but that wouldn't surprise me. 3 trillion, I think, as it currently stands. It's a very large number.
They've got the money to spend, Jane. The question is whether, I suppose the question is whether also China will be able to collect on its loans, because there's a lot of money owing to China now, isn't there, from countries that can't really afford to pay it?
I think that's going to be a huge challenge for China, and I'm interested to see how people interpret it. What we saw from the beginning with the Belt and Road narrative, and I think particularly from the West, is that China was intent on deliberately trapping countries into debt. You know, we called it debt trap diplomacy, an idea that really doesn't make sense to me as an economist. I can't imagine why you would deliberately channel money into a poor country, expect poor returns, put them into a debt position and lose your money in them, and then try and exert your influence somewhere. I just think there's much better ways to influence. The Chinese government will face the decision of either having to let some of that debt go or to slow down the payments, you know, to give some relief where they think they can and ought. But essentially, some of those projects are going to go horribly wrong. I don't think that's going to be the Chinese government's fault, but I bet that people will find a way to spin it so that it looks that way.
To what extent does that apply to places like Vanuatu, the Cook Islands, Fiji? Vanuatu owes China 220-odd million, Fiji half a billion, Tonga one-third of its GDP, that's $160 million. That's the interesting question. To what extent, if those payments are slowed or if those payments are unable to be made or if someone wants, you know, a debt jubilee for a while, what kind of influence can China exert politically?
I would say probably a pretty big one. Influence can be used in ways both good and bad, and we might see the Chinese government finding ways to exert negative influence on Vanuatu. And whatever they do in the South Pacific, of course, the Australians and New Zealanders are unlikely to enjoy that. But it is also possible that they'll come to the rescue and that the South Pacific Islanders will look towards them in a more friendly fashion because of the help that they've been given. And I guess that's what China wants. It doesn't sound to me like necessarily an evil plot for them to take over the region.
No, and it's not necessarily an evil plot, but this debt trap diplomacy, as you call it, with Sri Lanka, they had to give the Chinese ownership of the port that the Chinese developed. So that's not great PR for this kind of diplomacy, is it?
Well, it's a good case that you raise there. What happened in the Sri Lankan case was that a corrupt government in Sri Lanka misused the funds and found themselves unable to pay the loan. The narrative that then gets spun on that debt trap is that China somehow, you know, the Chinese government did that deliberately. But actually the story about the Hambantota port, if you read carefully, is about an incompetent Sri Lankan government. It's not about a malevolent intent from Beijing, in my view.
Yeah, and the same might apply to Turkmenistan. You know, with its gas reserves, lost Russia as a customer. The Chinese developed the gas infrastructure through huge loans. Price of gas went down. Turkmenistan can't service the loans. There are those scenarios, I suppose, big and small, and a number I probably haven't heard of, popping up all over the place. So you do have a series of problems for both those countries and for China, though, don't you now?
In the case of Turkmenistan and the gas, you know, if China can somehow find a way to secure cheaper gas supplies as a part of the repayment for problems that arise through various projects, if the gas comes online, then that solves their energy security problem as well. And that's a security issue that they take very seriously.
But the problem with some of these countries is that they may be facing economic ruin, or certainly a parlous economic future. And you make the point, actually, that China can't both collect on its loans and retain friendships. I mean, in the eyes of the world, presumably it becomes a pariah if China is seen to collect too harshly.
I mean, they did loan the money in the first place under conditions that were agreed to by both parties. I think any leniency that they show in the debt repayments should be considered as a fairly decent move. You know, they could, by rights, stick to the terms and force those countries into very, very serious debt problems indeed. And I don't think they'll do that for exactly that reason. They don't want enemies all over the world blaming them for loaning them money that then was misused and putting them, their own countries then, into severe economic downturns. I just don't think the story is quite as, well, it's not a simple story, clearly.
No, of course not. But nevertheless, with the US elections in mind, especially, it's going to become a story that's pushed, isn't it, for the rest of the year?
Well, I think it's always important to be clear-headed about what the United States is trying to achieve here. And every single point that they make about the Belt and Road, and in fact about anything that China is doing at the moment, pushes this idea of a malign, you know, malign actions and policies being pushed by a communist regime. They, of course, this week released a strategic approach to the PRC where they are very clearly engaged now in a competitive strategy. Both the two superpowers are playing some pretty dirty, what I'd call geo-economic games. You know, these are using economic tools, the trade war, to punish another country for not doing what they want. China using the Belt and Road to try and win friends and influence countries is one way of looking at that, not necessarily a successful strategy at this point. But I think we really do need to keep coming back to the dynamics of those two superpowers to understand really anything that's happening both within and outside the China today.
The dynamics are really interesting. Xi Jinping warned about a black swan event with the potential, you know, to derail China's onward march at the People's National Congress in 2019. And he was dead right, actually, wasn't he?
Yeah, let's not assume that he was prophetic there. I mean, it's really awful timing for China. It's a travesty for the entire world. What a shame that that prediction came true.
I know it's impossible to predict, but it doesn't come at a good time for China because it's been exporting its Uber surveillance technology, you know, even to Muslim countries. Ironic, you know, considering the Uyghurs. This virus is having all sorts of consequences right at a time when China didn't need them in terms of its image abroad. You'd agree with that?
But surely the United States' image is also being decimated, and the combination of watching these two big players play games in so many different ways that I think threaten the future of the global order. I don't think the world will ever be the same again. And I really am pretty fearful about what lies ahead, not only because of what's coming out of China about the policies that are adopted towards the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, for example, but the policies coming from the United States as well suggest, I think we're pretty well able to say by now that we're in a Cold War, if not very close to being in one. And it's not a world that's going to look very nice at all for generations to come.
I'll ask you about that too. Professor Jane Golly is with us. So, does the debt owed China in the Pacific, in the end, does it revert the hearts and minds of Pacific nations, you know, towards the old kind of ANZUS countries and the US and Australia being their saviours and to a lesser extent New Zealand? What do you think happens there?
I don't know how it's viewed from within New Zealand, and, you know, Australians will consider this differently as well, but we have been pretty paternalistic in the Pacific. I think we've been in there for decades. We've been trying to improve the development outcomes of countries, and maybe with some success, but I don't think you could call it a glowing success story. I think what the Pacific Islanders like about Chinese money is that it does come in with fewer strings attached, and I think with also a greater sense of equality. There are developing countries. China puts itself forward as a wealthy but still developing country, you know, that shares some common goals, and that makes it attractive. Of course, then there's the turnaround and the fear that because of China's size, these small Pacific Islanders can have their sovereignty threatened and lose out to China in the long run. And that's a trade-off that we face as relatively small countries, obviously, that New Zealand does as well when you're dealing with a huge economic power like China.
Australia has a problem with China now, does it? I guess it's argued as well that New Zealand does too. I mean, Beijing has showed its displeasure with trade tariffs. And I noticed Jonathan Perlman in The Guardian saying this is unfamiliar territory for Australia. It's risky. And the old America has our back mantra may not apply as readily as in the past. What do you think?
So it's a big question. And of course, the focus has been on the COVID inquiry, whether or not, you know, the latest round of tariffs was a direct punishment for that COVID inquiry. I don't think that it was. I think the story goes back much further than that. I mean, Chinese officials here in Canberra and, you know, back in Beijing are deeply disappointed with the Huawei decision, I think, and more broadly as what they perceive to be Australia's turn away from them. You know, it's 2014, not that long ago, that our Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, was describing China as a true friend. And we certainly no longer use that language. And there is still the question of where we go from here. And what we're seeing is that when Beijing's unhappy, they can punish us economically. But even then, the trade story just isn't that simple. It takes two to tango, or in this case, I'd say it takes three to tango. You've got the United States engaged in a trade war with China, where President Trump has actually demanded that President Xi finds ways to force Chinese companies to buy hundreds of billions of dollars more agricultural products from the US. So then when you add that into the mix of, you know, China putting a tariff on our beef or our barley, well, isn't that possibly a sensible strategy so that they can appease the United States and buy from them instead? Also very, I think, diplomatically clever to put us in that awkward position. And we see it in the press in Australia this week. There's pressure on the Prime Minister to call Trump and say, what are you doing to us with this trade deal? Can you lighten up? I don't know if he'll go ahead with that, but I'd be doing that if I was the Prime Minister.
Look, and we've been on the wrong end of the Australian protectionist stance with apples that lasted for years and years and years. The big question, I see it being asked, but it's always vague, and so probably is the answer, is whether New Zealand and Australia have to choose in terms of allegiance, whether they can both continue, or especially Australia, walk that line between old-fashioned allegiance, solidarity with the United States, and at the same time, this increasing reliance on China as the major trading partner of both our countries.
Do we have to choose? The more we clearly align with the United States on things like their whole of government approach to punishing China over COVID or whatever the next issue might be, that will increasingly frustrate China, and they do have ways to then pull back against us. And so we will pay an economic cost for that. How do you find ways to navigate the two to try and play a positive role in finding ways where you can still cooperate? But also, you know, my recommendation to the Australian government would still be stand your ground when you need to, but pick your battles carefully and sit back and be a little cautious, because people are going to lose jobs over what you say. And that should always be pretty close to the top of any government's priority list, shouldn't it?
In the end, it's the losing jobs that sways politicians more than traditional alliances, you might think.
Well, I'd say in the past that's been the case, but what we've seen in Australia is a trend towards the economic voices being shut down. They were heavily criticised by the Hawks, you know, last week for actually standing up and saying, look, can we think about our trading links? And they come in and say, no, we're not going to think about that. The security context is more important, and that's what we're going to focus on. If you keep pushing that way, given the reliance that we have on China and the fact that there is no one else to rely on, you know, you can talk about diversification until the cows come home, and it's not a bad strategy in theory. It's just that there are no other markets for us. So don't you again want to then tread a little bit carefully, bide your time, and figure out again those ways in which you can continue to work with your number one trading partner, unless you think complete decoupling and separation from them is the ideal outcome? And if that's the case, get prepared for much smaller economies and a lot of unemployment, you know, and again, that causes me sleepless nights.
It's a different kind of Cold War, isn't it, this time? Because it's a Cold War between China and a country with an isolationist, a renewed isolationist impulse under Trump, isn't it, really?
Well, and that's what just makes it all so tricky. And you come back to that, the trade war where Trump comes and puts tariffs on China and tries to start blocking their, you know, their trade with them as one strategy. You've then got China with the Belt and Road saying, well, we've got capital to spend. You know, are there any countries who want to accept it? We'll create jobs for you and see what follows from there. You know, as if sitting in the South Pacific or in any other developing country in the world, it's a pretty clear choice to me which one of those you'd opt for. And that is part of, I think, what deeply concerns the Americans and I guess the Australians, possibly the New Zealanders as well, is that one way of putting it is that China's actually playing a pretty sensible geostrategic or geoeconomic game, although certainly that's not how lots of people see it.
Yeah, and it's not going all China's way, or at least not as smoothly as we thought before the virus. The last question, and I know it's a hard one, but Scott Morrison says it's vital to get the Australian economy out of ICU, you know, and off the medication of government support before it becomes too accustomed to it. There may be a vaccine, and this virus crisis may end up just being worse than the GFC, but not full-blown. Or as with black swans, you don't know where they'll fly and for how long. So I detected a note of pessimism from you earlier, or at least a suggestion from you that we just don't know yet, but it could be really bad.
I think all of the forces are combining to make me feel pretty darn pessimistic. Just look at the university sector here in Australia. We've lost something like 22,000 jobs, or predicted to lose 22,000 jobs, $3 to $4.6 billion in the first 6 months of the COVID crisis alone. Jobs are shedding at a time when our relationship with China is deteriorating, and I think it is likely that we'll see fewer Chinese students coming our way. Now, a lot of people want that to happen as an outcome. They think we're too dependent on China in the university sector, and that may well be true. But unless the Australian government steps in and fills that gap, the university sector shrinks. And that plays out in a whole bunch of different sectors. I mean, the university sector is a good one where that sounds like a fantastic strategy to me, that the government would pour more money into the sector, give us more independence from China and keep the sector thriving. But I don't think it's the number one priority of the Australian government at the moment.
That's a whole other interview, the future of universities, isn't it? We could probably talk for 20 minutes and speak out, but that doesn't look so bright either right around the world.
The Chinese government, meanwhile, is pumping so much money into their university sector. They open, on average, one university a week since 1978. I mean, the numbers, you know, and so they become competitors. Of course, one's not particularly good competitors when you have a system that is constrained by academic freedom and you're not allowed to say anything that criticises the government. That doesn't sound like the most appealing university to me, but we might see that competition playing out in the university space, and we'll certainly see likely to see Chinese student numbers falling, leaving holes not just in the Australian university sector but across the Western world as well.
Good to have your thoughts on that, but in particular your earlier thoughts on China and what is happening. It's going to be a rocky road ahead. Very good of you to talk to us, Professor Jane Golley. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jim.